Bob, what are you doing?
Oh, I got one of those Santa lists from the post office, and I'm buying the gifts.
That's great and very generous of you.
And I got one for you, too.
Oh, thank you. Sue and I like to do this every year.
I know. It's very rewarding. And I really think that you should get every gift on their list to make the little tykes happy.
A high-end dynamic Shure SM7B mic for podcasting. Well, that's unusual. Custom Batmobile LED stripe lighting for underneath and interior accents on your car. This child drives. Wow. And a pair of limited edition Air Jordan Christmas themed sneakers. Who exactly is this for?
They don't say, but it is important that you make sure to purchase all of the items listed. You know, it's kind of what you do. And then just give them to me. I will make sure they end up with the right person.
I'm sure you will.
Hey, and while you're at it, Mark, I also have a list that is definitely not for me, but for a poor, unfortunate, adorable little child who's just looking for a Gibson Les Paul for Christmas. They specifically said not to get him one of those cheap Epiphones, and that you should probably just give it to me, and that I'll get it to them. I promise.
I trust him.
No, I wouldn't.
The following podcast contains graphic descriptions of international celebrating and global merrymaking. It may not be suitable for angry or unhappy audience members. Listener discretion is advised. You've been warned.
Have you ever seen any of those foreign films? I don't like them.
Some are born great, others achieve greatness, and some watch Christmas movies.
For Natale! God is helping!
We are the wild and pretty guys!
Well, they're both festive, aren't they?
The Festive Foreign Film Fans Special! Royal English Christmas / New Year's Triple Stuffed Podcast Episode Extravaganza!
Not to take us off topic, Mark.
Never.
But I hate to break this to you because it may be an unpopular opinion, but bigger is better. I know you've always heard the opposite. We try to convince the women that we know that is not true. But trust me, I know. And it's a bit of a curse. You know why?
Why?
You need bigger pants. It's harder to get through security. You get those awkward looks at the gym.
I bet you do.
Because no guy likes to see someone else with a bigger...
What do you say? What?
Oreo. A bigger Oreo. You know, double-stuffed Oreos. Especially when you're eating them in the locker room. I mean, you get those weird... Like, what are you doing with those? Or you stuff them in your pockets to get through the airport. I mean, let's be honest. The double-stuffed Oreo is better than the normal one. It is the real example of what happens when humanity dares to dream big. If you want to succeed, you need to laugh in the face of moderation. And we have adopted that philosophy for today's show. Because
you worried me.
Us festive fans, we believe that overstuffing instantly makes it better. Look how overstuffed we are. Think burritos.
Okay.
Pillows.
Okay.
Or even stockings. When you need two hands and possibly even a foot to handle it, most likely perfect.
Wait, do you say you need two hands because it's a foot? Is that what you said? I may have misinterpreted.
But it's most likely perfect because you know that more really is more.
It's true.
Which brings us to today's episode.
Yes.
We have embraced the power of threes, which, you know, is a classic principle that says that things that are grouped in threes are more satisfying. They're more memorable and they're more impactful than any other numbers. Twos, fours, six. Three is it. Three just seems to hit the sweet spot with jokes, with slogans, with stories. The power of threes works. And so we're going with it.
So like threesomes.
Mark.
Get it now?
I guess because you're sitting there in your Christmas negligee, but please think about it. It works. We're going to go with it. We're going to go on for 3 hours. We have the three of us, you and I and Jake, but we also have added three movies and three guests. We're tripling our efforts. And the reason why we're doing it, because we are off to the holy grail of Christmas countries. Well, maybe next to Bethlehem. I mean, I don't want to dismiss it, but we need to be up to the task. That's why we're putting everything out there. Well, not everything, but a lot of things. It was English writer Charles Dickens who helped to transform Christmas from a modest religious observance into a joyful family celebration focused on goodwill, compassion, and generosity. So in that spirit of England being the birthplace for our modern Christmas celebrations and traditions, we feel not worthy. This is the moment we've been waiting for since this podcast began.
Yes.
But we have butterflies. How can we possibly salute our English friends in proper British fashion? But before we get into enjoying our meetings, we need to go back to our previous country. Back to Georgia, the home to real Christmas trees. We're going to collect some of its incredibly valuable pine cones. But we also asked you about the form of swimming that was named after the country. But if once you know, it seems like more like a form of torture than a style of swimming. Georgian swimming requires that your hands and your feet be tied together, so that the only way to swim in the water is to move your hips and flap your bound feet. And it's supposed to get you to copy the movements of seals, dolphins, whales. And supposedly, I mean, they have training. You go to places and you learn to do this. It helps you to attain an optimal swimming ability.
Yeah.
If you don't drown. So if you knew this answer, if you were a fan of, or maybe an active participant of Georgian swimming, you received our thoughtful little one-size-fits-all Christmas gift that is able to delight youngsters and seniors alike because it provides bursts of colorful joy wherever you stick it. It's the 4F sticker.
I was surprised that your in-law family didn't send something because I am aware of this and you see it in the Olympics.
Oh, do you see Georgian swimming in the Olympics?
Yeah. I mean, when they dive in, they sort of,
they do
I'm
that
just curious
of, yeah.
if that, but that's yeah. when that question came up, I kind of knew the answer. They've made swim time so much faster and effective. So,
and just as an aside, the reason why Mark brings it up, my son's father-in-law, Peter Rocca, was an Olympic swimmer. Yeah, he ran the silver medal in Montreal.
Yeah, I think next time you see Peter, I think you need to ask him about
this. I'm going to. I will. Those of you who didn't win a sticker, just so you know, they're able to be pre-ordered for next Christmas. So please get your orders in. Speaking of the Yuletide season, and today we have to admit that this episode presents an odd dichotomy. A ye old English Christmas brings such an air of anticipation for us, but also a strange ache. I mean, we have been eagerly looking forward to talking about Christmas in the UK, but once we do, it'll be over and on to the next country. And we really couldn't wait to put the spotlight on England, especially since they have many really good movies, and we couldn't even pick amongst the three that we have. We're going to be sad when it's over, like Christmas itself. But let's toast to the granddaddy of Christmas, the keeper of carols, plum pudding, paper crowns, Father Christmas, and ghost stories, England.
Want to watch a Christmas movie?
Christmas movies are our bread and butter.
We eat Chinese food and watch Christmas movies.
I heard it's the best Christmas movie since Home Alone.
So for tonight's episode, we're going to talk about three different actors from each of the films. Then we'll talk a little bit about each film, but at a high level in the plot. And then we're going to have different questions tonight than our typical was it festive or not. So the first actor we want to talk about is Nicholas Hoult. He plays Marcus Brewer in the film About a Boy. Nicholas Holt has received several accolades, including a nomination for a British Academy Film Award, or BAFTA, two Golden Globe nominations, and a Primetime Emmy nomination. His breakthrough role came at age 11 when he played Marcus in About a Boy alongside Hugh Grant. Prior to that, he appeared in minor television and film roles in British productions, having started acting at the age of 3 with his debut in the film Intimate Relations in 1996.
Doesn't sound appropriate for a 3-year-old.
No, it doesn't. He quickly followed up with About a Boy and then with the American film The Weatherman as Nicolas Cage's son. Which I remember that movie, but I can't really remember him.
Son, yeah.
At 17, he played in the British series Skins, which helped him transition from a child star to a more complex, darker character, leading to success and critical recognition. By the time he was 20, he played the role of Kenny Potter in the Oscar-nominated film A Single Man. He was most recently seen as Lex Luthor in Superman.
No, I didn't see. Did you see Superman?
I did not see the most recent version. No. I did see A Single Man, though.
I was going to ask you, because Oscar nominated. Do you remember him as Kenny Potter?
Okay. I don't remember him standing out.
Yeah.
It almost makes me want to go back. In the next movie, A Christmas Carol Gone Wrong, Sir Derek Jacobi is like the preeminent classic British actor known for his roles in stage and screen. You see him, you're probably going to take a knee and bow, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But he was knighted in 1994 for his services to the theater. His interest in drama began when he was young, not shockingly. His family was working class, but he rose to be a great Shakespearean actor. He's portrayed Hamlet at the English National Youth Theater in high school and earned a scholarship to the University of Cambridge. He caught the interest of Sir Laurence Olivier, who took him under his wing. Olivier provided Derek his film classic debut as Cassio in Othello. His breakthrough came in the epic BBC series I, Claudius, where he did win a BAFTA award. Films tend to play a distant third in his career behind the stage and TV, which I think is interesting. He's really a classic theatrical performer.
It's funny he's in this movie because
he
doesn't really play that big of a part, but he's the one people would know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it's awesome that he lent his talent to the show. So he's won a Tony on Broadway and several Emmys for his work on television. He's most recently seen on Netflix series The Crown in 2019, which he was phenomenal in. The beauty of A Christmas Carol Goes Wrong is how it uses classically trained actor in a parody of a live performance of A Christmas Carol. And then the last actor we'll highlight for tonight is Alex Ettel, who plays Damian Cunningham in the movie Millions. Alexander Ettel is best known for his film debut in Millions. He garnered over 4 prestigious award nominations. His acting debut wasn't the result of an extensive training or industry connections. He just responded to a casting call, and he impressed director Danny Boyle with his authenticity, which is amazing. I mean, this is a great movie, and this kid just shows
up. He is stunning.
Critics cite his ability to convey depth beyond his years, positioning him as an exceptional young talent. He also appeared in The Water Horse, Legend of the Deep in 2007. Then he stepped away from acting around 2010 and graduated from Leeds Beckett University in 2016, earning a degree in music technology. After the university, Ettel leveraged his skills in cybersecurity and web development and was co-founder of Sinister Records. He's facilitated more than 50 live events promoting both established and emerging artists. So he actually got away from acting. He's focusing his music.
What is stunning to me, of the 3 we talked about, all of them are outstanding. This kid looked like he had an amazing career as an actor. And that he stepped away. It stuns me.
It is. It's amazing. So let's talk about the 3 films at a high level, right? You won't go into depth, but I'll start with About a Boy. About a Boy is probably of the 3 the most well-known, but it does star Hugh Grant. Hugh Grant plays this very rich person who's single, sort of just kind of going through life. He's getting money because his father created a song, a Christmas song.
Novelty Christmas song
that gets played and over. And so he leads the rich single bachelor life, hopping from girlfriend to girlfriend. And as any good movie would have it, he decides that dating single moms is sort of his next adventure. So he goes to a help group called Single Families Act Together and starts dating this one girl who's a single mom, lies that he has a kid, but he really doesn't. And then
horrible,
right? And so she kind of calls him out on it. But in one of the dates they go on, she brings along this boy, said, "My gosh, my girlfriend's, she's kind of down in the dumps. Do you mind if I bring this kid Marcus with us?" Marcus is bullied at school and shows up at Will's house, and they sort of develop this relationship. And Will
grudgingly,
yeah. Yeah. It doesn't come right away, yeah. But Will starts to really see, like, wow, I really like this kid. Yeah. And so then eventually Will starts thinking, like, well, I got to reevaluate my life. I got to really think about this. Meets the beautiful, one of my all-time favorite actresses from the Mummy series, Rachel Weisz, and she intrigues Will because she's interesting and she has a kid, and her lies to her and says that he has a son who is this Marcus, and Marcus is willing to play along. But in the end, as these movies often do, there's complications, there's humor, there's love, there's the missed opportunities. Will falls in love with Rachel. Marcus, you know, sort of adopts Will as his father. And at the end, the movie sort of ends with Marcus's mom and a new boyfriend and Will and Rachel Weisz character all being sort of happily together. So.
What I love is it bookends. First off, all his money comes from his dad's Christmas tune. It has an awkward Christmas scene at the beginning, and it shows how everyone has changed with a really nice family Christmas scene at the end. So in some ways, Christmas is a part of it. But it doesn't take place at Christmas time only or anything.
I mean, if we were talking about festive or non-festive, this would definitely be a festive film.
Oh, yeah.
The second movie is, I'll go next with Millions.
Yeah.
Millions is about two boys. And again, I didn't tell Sue this, but again, that's a movie where the mom is dead.
Yes.
I don't know why this happens.
I know.
In this movie, Damien Cunningham and his brother, they are leaving their old house, moving into a new house. Damien is taking all the cardboard boxes from all the things that they just bought and builds sort of this little fort out in a field. And a train goes whizzing by. And all of a sudden you hear this boom, 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 boom. And the big black bag hits his cardboard house, and it turns out it's packed full of money. And Damien also has a tendency to see things that aren't there. He's a connoisseur and knows all about every saint, knows when they lived, what they were known for, when they were martyred, if that was the case.
When they got their eyes plucked out.
When they got their eyes. I mean, there's a funny scene in the beginning where they moved to this new school, and the teacher is asking the students the first day of school, who's their favorite person? And everybody starts naming famous football players, soccer players, and he names some saint.
Yeah.
Right? And they're like, oh, what team does he play for? And he's like, no, that's Saint blah blah, who was martyred on this date. Anyway, this money comes to them. He takes the money. Damien takes the money, shows his brother. And his brother immediately is like, all right, we can't tell dad. And Damien all along kept saying, we got to give this money back. It's not ours. We have to be honest about it. This movie takes you through all the different gyrations of what happens when you try to hide money. And the brother hands out money to the people at school. And there's this great scene where they show up at their house in the morning. He gets on the pedals of a bike. One kid rides him in. One guy grabs his backpack. Two others or three others run security for him. And they're sort of escorting him to school. And it's funny because he keeps telling Damien, don't tell anybody, but he's like flashing cash all over the place. Damien along the way is trying to figure out what to do with the money. They obviously both miss their mom incredibly.
Yes.
And, you know, the dad's doing what he can to sort of get them into a stable life. But, you know, they're on hard times. And Damien is sort of hinting at times, like he sees there's these Latter-day Saints. They're supposed to live this life of poverty. And so he asks them, he says, are you poor? And he goes, like, what do you mean, are you poor? Well, are you poor? He's like, well, like, we don't have a dishwasher. We don't have this, we don't have that. And so Damien takes wads of cash and sticks it into the mailbox. And it's funny, I think that's when Saint Nick is with him.
Yes.
And he's like, that's good. That's good. That's that you're giving money to those, you know, in need. And on the one hand, you have Damien who's trying to do the right thing. You have his brother who's trying not to do the thing. They're hiding from the dad. But then the original robber figures out maybe that they have the money. So he starts socking. The other backdrop to this whole thing is too, is it's right before England joins the EU. So they're getting rid of all their old pounds and sterling and turning it into the euro. And so they have that as the background too. So they only have so many days to do it. Well, the robber comes into the house looking for the money, demolishes the house. That's when they reveal to dad they have the money. And like you think, oh, good, the dad's going to do the right thing. He's going to make him deliver it back to the police. No. His dad's like, we deserve this. We earned this. We're going to go change all this money to euros, spend some of the money. And so they go out with the girlfriend. He's kind of now has this girlfriend who helps him devise a way to get rid of the money. There was a scene at the end where he's able to reconnect with his mom. She tells him everything's going to be okay. He burns the rest of the money that they have left. And then there's a new family unit now with his dad, his brother, this new woman. They're sort of all getting along. So I had not seen this movie before. It was delightful. It was a very cute movie. And then the last movie was the Christmas Carol Gone Wrong. So the premise of this movie is that there's this theatrical group who was banned from being on the BBC because of the Easter show that did not go correctly. And so at the very beginning of the movie, Derek Jacobi playing Scrooge, performing, all of a sudden you see all these black hooded people coming in with dark coverings on their faces and taking over the broadcast immediately. And to say they're inept at the show is to put it mildly. And so they quickly take over the show. Most of the acting is so poor. The one guy who plays Bob Cratchit, he makes me laugh. He doesn't know his words, so he's written them all over scenery. Like the one's like, would you like to give that coin? He has on his coin. He has his yes and no. And they would like to give that coin to the poor. And he looks at the coin. Yes. And, would you like to give it now if it was a coin? No. Yes. No. And it sort of follows all along. I mean, it's hilarious at the British physical humor, slapstick humor that occurs. And so as they're going through, though, the guy who's playing Scrooge, there's another actor who wants to play Scrooge. And he's like, I will never let you play Scrooge unless there's something untimely happens to me where you have to take over. Well, embedded in the whole thing is, you know, him trying to take out that guy so he could play Scrooge.
Right.
And so they go through the play. But really, as you go through it, you realize the guy who plays Scrooge is maybe not the nicest guy in real life. You know, as he's playing and he's starting to sort of have this realization that maybe he's not such a good person. And at the end, he tells this other understudy, why don't you play Scrooge? And he's like, no, you play Scrooge. And at one scene, you have those two both playing Scrooge. And you have Derek Jacobi come back and playing Scrooge. So you have three different characters playing Scrooge all at the same time. It's just a hilarious film. This one, brand new to me. And it's so fast and so creative. There's a part two where in the scene, one of the women gets a handgun stuck to her hand. It's a little pistol. And then they have to go off of the property and they go to the store to get some food. And she's like, you know, you need to give us this food. And she's pointing the gun at him, not realizing that's what she's doing. And the clerk's like, yeah, of course, you know, and she realizes, and she's like, give them food too. He's like, okay, ma'am. Very typical of British humor, you know, just a delight.
What is so funny is they put on the show, like the show goes on,
right?
But they keep finding so many funny ways to put in jokes or physical gags. But what I do like about it too is the same story happens where he has a moment, he's been nasty to the people around him. He realizes he has, and he changes his ways. And so it tells the story just in a different way, and it makes it even more meaningful.
Yeah, and there's a lot of sub stories, like guy who thinks his girlfriend is cheating.
What you love, there's one scene, and this is what makes it so funny, is they're trying to use green screen.
Yes. Oh my
God. The guy's using on his computer and he accidentally showed a video he took from a Christmas party that keeps getting, they keep seeing scenes of it because it's on his computer. And so many things come from that. It's so funny.
So that's the three movies, all very delightful. We have different questions for ourselves tonight.
Yeah, four Fs. So.
Four Fs. So the first question is, which was the best, Bob?
These are films I was familiar with. I knew all three of them. The one I have watched repeatedly, although I love all of them equally, I have watched Millions a number of times. The reason why, and it's hard to portray when you're describing the movie, Damien, he's like the ethical center because he loves these saints and he's trying to understand morality and all the various things he does. It's so interesting in terms of trying to give money away. What's the right thing to do with money? And even the end of the film, it's very uplifting and it's so touching where he sees his mother and talks to his mother, and the kid is amazing. So my favorite, although I love all of them for different reasons, my favorite is Millions.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, even in the description, when I learned that this was his first film and I learned that he sort of just answered a casting call, he's so authentic.
Yes.
I could see your point of view. I struggle with this one a little bit, but I would say the one I've watched the most and maybe I've learned about the most is About a Boy.
Oh.
I mean, I really do enjoy that story. Again, I'm a huge Hugh Grant fan. I just think it's somewhat of a predictable story in that, right, there's just somebody who needs to sort of reevaluate their life. But I just love how Marcus just keeps coming back and figures out early on that Will needs him as much as he needs Will.
And that kid is another one that does a great job.
I just love the tenacity of Marcus with A Christmas Carol Gone Wrong being new. I don't know. It could end up being one eventually, but I always go back to About a Boy.
The one thing about A Boy is you'll never be able to listen to Killing Me Softly with the same way ever again.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we went more in depth, we would talk about that. Yeah. All right, so then how would you rank them? So it sounds like Millions is one for you.
I would do it this way. It's almost like one ABC. Like my third, I rank it so far ahead of other ones that it's almost unfair, but I would go Millions, Christmas Carol Gone Wrong, and About a Boy. I love About a Boy. I watch that a lot too, because there's so many scenes I like in that. The thing about Christmas Carol Gone Wrong, I've watched it. I laugh out loud still. So it funny. Still gets me to laugh.
So it's funny. We're flip-flopped a little bit. So I would say About a Boy, Christmas Carol, and Millions. But again, same thing. I like the character development About a Boy. Christmas Carol just made me laugh.
Yeah.
Again, Millions is very good. I would say that would be my order. Which one do you feel is most authentically British?
This is a hard question because I want to say Millions again because there's certain things, the soccer element to it, the schooling, how they behave at school, the house, how they built the house, all of those factors. And I don't say About a Boy, even though there's British elements of that, but that could feel the most American to me.
True.
It's A Christmas Carol. How do you not? I mean, it's...
I couldn't agree more.
And the humor is so British.
Oh, my God. And you know, it's funny, watching that, it took me back to my first introduction to British humor was Monty Python. Yes. And it just reminded me of that. And Benny Hill.
Yes.
Right. And Mr. Bean.
And this is all in keeping with all those. It's a peer with those. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Would you watch again or recommend any of these to
all
someone?
Three. Yeah, all same. Three. Damn. Without a doubt.
They're so good.
And like I said, I've watched them again and again myself.
In this Christmas season, we have watched as a family Christmas Carol Gone Wrong. Most of my family had never seen it before.
Oh, really? You did? So did they love it?
Everybody did. And I would say, for those listening, if you haven't watched it yet, it's not a very long movie.
No.
It's like maybe 80 minutes. If you are having your worst day, just watch this.
I'm so glad the whole family watched it. Because I've never done that with my family. I think I have to do it.
Yeah, I would highly recommend it.
So, Mark, we indicated we have three movies. We also have three interviewees. They are all from England, which is fun. So we can gain from them a perspective on English Christmas versus American Christmas, what traditions they have. The first person we're going to talk to, his name is Adam Parker Sebun. He has a podcast.
Okay.
And it's called Merry Britsmas. It's a podcast that celebrates all things Christmas in Britain, from its timeless holiday music, heartwarming films, quirky traditions, Yuletide nostalgia. He has all that. He hails from England, and we want to hear from him what makes Christmas so special in the UK and some of his favorite Christmas memories. Merry Britsmas is a festive podcast that celebrates all things Christmas in Britain, from its timeless holiday music and heartwarming films to quirky traditions and Yuletide nostalgia. In America, I think so many of our customs stem from not only just England, but Charles Dickens in general, you know?
I just realized I should be doing something. I've always wanted to have a podcast, but never really found something specific to talk about. I'd almost like too many things as well. Like I love music and I love film and I love sports. And so I was like, I got to know what to click into. And then Christmas just kind of matched up with something that I love so much and seemed to be a burgeoning podcast area. And a friend of mine said, after I was racking my brains about what to talk about on Christmas, because it seems like, where's my expertise? A friend said, all the ones you kind of listen to are American. Why don't you do something British? And then it just clicked for me. It was that eureka moment, like, yeah, of course, just a British Christmas. No one's else talking about that. Everyone's talking about things that are generally quite American. So I'll give my perspective on, and as I kind of then started digging into it, realizing how many things are uniquely British and how many British shows and music is out there that other cultures and other countries just aren't seeing.
So where are you specifically from? And does where you are at in England determine how you celebrate? Like, are there geographical differences?
I grew up in the middle of England, a place near, it's sort of the Midlands, we call it, near Birmingham, a little town called Kidderminster. Then went to Southampton on the south coast for university, moved to London for about 8 or 9 years. And now I'm on the Sussex coast, on the south coast near Brighton and Hove. And I wouldn't say there's any major differences. English Christmas has become, I wouldn't say all the same, but it's not vastly different as opposed to, maybe because we're a relatively small nation and there's differences in things like accents and certain slang words. And that's the main thing I get, is my accent is a little bit different from some people down south.
Yep.
And I'll say words differently or mispronounce or pronounce things differently, or I have a few nicknames for things that other people don't understand down south. You do get very specific Christmas stuff to certain areas. Say, for example, if you live by the sea, quite a lot of seaside places will do a Christmas Day swim. So we do one here down on the south coast where I live. You know, people will go down on Christmas Day and go in this water for, and that's very regional based. And then you have certain events in places, like I've looked at places in Oxfordshire and places in Newcastle who do specific Christmas weird events in December. So there might be almost challenging things like throwing the Christmas pudding or weird things that are sort of probably been going for a couple of hundred years in a really small little village or town.
There you go.
If I went to spend Christmas up in Newcastle or over in Cornwall or in London, you generally have the same touchstones. It would be mostly the same. Christmas dinner would be the same, like, generally speaking. You'd have differences within families. So there's between me and my wife's family, her family have a couple of dishes on their Christmas dinner, which is we don't have. And so you get those little family things. But I think England is a bit more homogenous as a sort of celebration, maybe because it's just a smaller nation and the way we've developed kind of thing, our culture is a bit more centralized, like compared to the States in America.
What we want to know, what we're curious about, and what's always hard for us to do, it's easy to Google what's Christmas like. And a lot of the material, you always wonder, is this really true? So England, you put a podcast out where you talk about Christmas in Britain all the time. We really want to understand. So what is that classic English Christmas that you would say most English people would say, yes, that is Christmas?
I think there are certain things over the course of the holiday season that people say that's what makes Christmas almost. I think one of the first things that has become a bit more modern, but I'd say that I've noticed more and more, is the Christmas food, snacks and sandwiches in shops, especially Christmas sandwiches. they're out in shops now. People kind of start talking about them and going to get Christmas sandwiches. There's a shop here called Marks and Spencer, which is like a slightly upmarket. They do, it's almost like a department store. They have like clothes sections and they have quite a big food section usually. And they do Christmas sandwiches every year and people kind of go a bit mad for them. And it becomes a bit of a staple of people's holidays waiting for the Christmas sandwiches to come out. And they usually have a few that are similar, like some turkey ones and brie and cranberry. And then a few new ones they'll kind of make for the, each season. And I think that's become a proper weird little kind of first signpost almost of English Christmas, along with the adverts, well, the Christmas adverts. Those are the two things that are, that's the start of almost the Christmas celebrations for a lot of people in England. And as you get closer to Christmas, you start to have, obviously, this is the preparation for the dinner. It's a big roast dinner, traditionally. And there are a few things that I'd say are more traditionally British, so pigs in blankets. You know, I don't know anyone that doesn't have pigs in blankets on their Christmas dinner nowadays. It's a standard, you know, a small sausage, like a cocktail sausage, wrapped in bacon, usually double wrapped in bacon, and then just cooked. And that's it. So it's like a bite-sized thing.
What about roasted chestnuts? Are they available on the street corners?
Or? You do see them in like city centres. There'll be someone selling them, like usually a stall in town, but they're not everywhere. But you definitely see them. And you only see them at Christmas as well. That's the only time you'll see them.
So the two things you have highlighted, the adverts, I love those. That's a great tradition. And then the sandwiches. What's funny is that hasn't carried over here, but I listened to the song and I hear you guys talk about the sandwiches, and that sounds awesome. They sound really, really good. But
it's very enjoyable. And I do my own kind of thing where I make an epic Christmas sandwich closer in like the week or two before Christmas, and kind of I make it out of like a giant round cob roll and hollow out and fill it with Christmas fillings. So turkey, pigs in blankets. I'd usually go with some stuffing as well, cranberry sauce, some sort of spinach to make it slightly healthy, some sort of greens, and then some sort of cheese. I usually use brie sometimes. I've used mozzarella weirdly before just to see, because I like the gooiness of it. Kind of then compress it and just like chop it into slices. That's my usual Christmas sandwich.
Our impression overall is that Dickens was the one that really kind of helped to create, to format like the modern Christmas. From an American perspective, we kind of think some of these customs came to true. I mean, do you guys feel that way in England, or are we just...
Yeah, I think there is still a real appreciation and respect for the Dickensian cultural power and impact. Obviously, Christmas Carol, it's my favourite book ever, I think. I read it every year a couple of times. As a teacher, I'm quite lucky in that we teach it in my school. And so I get to read it at Christmas, and I dress up as the Ghost of Christmas Present for them. I don't know if they appreciate that, but I do it anyway. I've got a lot of gusto into reading it to them. And so I get to kind of pass that along, that enjoyment of it. I think you really do see Victorian Christmas into the modern, the stuff like Christmas cards and crackers, those sort of, you know, very British Christmas things are invented in that time period. And we still make part of our day-to-day Christmas events now. You can kind of see it in a lot of British Christmas celebration and culture. Christmas adverts quite often will have a Dickensian feel to them. There was definitely one, I think it was last year or the year before, and it was playing on almost a Christmas Carol Dickens sort of thing. And so it's a touchstone, a cultural touchstone in the UK.
And tell me what Christmases was like for you growing up.
Yeah, it was, my mom's the big Christmas, she's the reason why I am a Christmas obsessive. My mom is obsessed with Christmas like I am. She would, you know, as soon as my dad would allow her, whack every decoration up, kind of go a little bit mad with the decorations. And she used to make it really special. Like she'd make sure there's lots of sort of food in the house and decorations. And she used to buy me and my brother, the kind of one of my earliest memories is getting Christmas pajamas on Christmas Eve. Yeah. And we'd get our Christmas pajamas and we could each pick one present, I think, as well. Like a smaller present from a stocking. The one kind of strange Christmas tradition that we had was on Christmas Eve, we'd have Christmas pork sandwiches, we'd call them. So my dad would cook a big butt of pork and then we'd chop it up and make sandwiches on Christmas Eve. I don't know where that came from. That was just my Christmas. And sometimes family would come over and have that as well. And then Christmas Day was lots of seeing all my aunties. I've got lots of aunties and uncles. So a variation of them coming to us going to them, visiting people, going all over the place. And we'd usually go for some sort of walk as well, like a Christmas Day walk with the when we had the dog. So we used to, you know, walk our dog out on Christmas Day. It was always quite a nice tradition as well. And then there'd usually be the Christmas Day fight between my brother that would eventually, 3 years difference between us. So there was always some sort of argument or fight. For us growing up and even now, Boxing Day, which I haven't mentioned yet, is a big British Christmas thing. That was just as important today as Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. You know, Boxing Day, we'd again go see other family and friends, have big leftovers, maybe have people over for like a little dinner or something, or like lots of all the bits left over. Sometimes as well, a big thing here that I really loved going to when I was younger, on Boxing Day, we'd have a football match, English football matches on Boxing Day. It's quite a tradition. And so we'd go watch our local team, which is Kidderminster Harriers, if they had a home game. We'd often go and watch that on Boxing Day, which would be like a nice thing for me and my dad and my brother and a few friends to do. My nan was a very unique lady, and she was a publican her whole life. So she ran pubs. And when she got older, she was a very frugal woman, and she always used to go and obsessively kind of every single day go to charity shops, which are like thrift shops, I suppose, thrift stores, you'd call them, you know, secondhand people stuff. And she would always buy the weirdest things and bring them around to our house and carry things around in a bin bag and just turn up with the oddest things. I remember once she bought me like an anti-venom kit, like a snake anti-venom kit. And I'm like, we live in the middle of England. There's no snakes here. And sadly, a few years ago, she passed away. And the following Christmas, my parents came up with the idea of doing a kind of a secret Santa charity shop thing. And so what we all do is we all have to go and buy something from a charity shop that's a bit weird or wacky or strange or unusual, and it can be quite interesting or it could just be really funny. And then we wrap them up, put them all in a black bin bag on Christmas Day, and then everyone picks a present out, you know, blind. So as long as you don't pick your own present, you pick out whatever you get, and then you open it and we all have a bit of a laugh at the weird stuff we've got. It might be like a fun game we could play, or it might be a fun bit of crockery, or like a weird mug, rude mug, or strange bit of kitchen items. It's whatever you find, really, kind of the weird and funny and wacky things, and it makes for quite a fun Christmas Day activity usually.
I love that. I want to do that.
And I remember I did take some stuff, like when I was at university, and I'd get stuff and I'd take it and kind of display it on a shelf at university. And my friends would be like, oh, is that the Nana Jones selection? Like, yeah, she bought me this now. She got me this little weird statue of a dragon or something that, I don't know, this weird little ashtray. I don't smoke. I don't know why she bought me an ashtray. Just like, you know, she'll get me something odd.
Are there any American influences on your Christmas versus British on ours?
Britain has just naturally kind of become a bit more Americanized, and probably more in my lifetime than any other because of TV and the internet and films and stuff. And so I'd say there's definitely been a sort of influx of American Christmas culture. Probably not so much when I was a kid, but as I got older, I definitely noticed it. Elf on the Shelf was kind of the biggest thing that I think.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd say some things like that have started to creep in, like traditions that are sort of a bit more new maybe, but have started off in America and then jumped over here after a few years.
What's a favorite English Christmas movie you like, and a Christmas song that you think is very representative of your country?
For my song, I picked something that, again, is over here. People would definitely be like, that's a Christmas song. As soon as it comes on, it's the start of Christmas. I Believe in Father Christmas by Greg Lake, who is in Emerson, Lake and Palmer and King Crimson. And it's just a beautiful, it's my dad's favorite Christmas song, whenever it would come on. And my dad's liked Christmas, but he liked it in the Christmas box for the 2 weeks around Christmas, whereas my mom was trying to explode it out everywhere else like me. But when that song came on, I remember he would sing along, you know, it would lift his spirits, and I absolutely adore that song. It's just something about it. It's very simple. It's a very sort of beautiful pop song about believing and sort of having that almost childlike sensation as an adult of the memories of Christmas, but still having that into adulthood. You know, I still believe in Father Christmas, and I remember these days before, and I still remember them now, and I'm going to hold that kind of thing and continue that feeling of belief. And yeah, that's a beautiful song.
They told me a fairy story, till I believed in the Israelite. And I believed in Father Christmas. I looked to the sky with excited eyes. Then I woke with a yawn in the first light of dawn, and I saw him in through his disguise.
In terms of a film, well, I'm going to pick something that is lesser well known, just because I want to make poor people watch this, which is, it was a made-for-TV movie over here in the late 90s, I want to say, called Flint Street Nativity. And it's, I think it's just over like an hour and 15 minutes long. And the premise is a bunch of children are getting ready to put on a nativity show for all the parents. And it's like you're seeing them backstage preparing and then seeing the show. What they've done is it's all adult comedians, British comedians, and some relatively well-known British comedians over here. And they all play the kids. And they built a set that's oversized. So all they're all dressed up like little kids in the nativity and they're playing in like, you know, the tables and the kids' chairs are all huge. And so they look little kind of thing. And you never see the adults, you only see the kids. And it's really funny. And all the kids kind of get into fights and arguments. There's one girl that wants to be Mary and the other girl's Mary. They're falling out with each other. There's a boy that's got a lisp and he can't say frankincense properly. There's another boy that fancies one of the girls. And it's just really funny, like these little kids kind of interactions. It's very sweet and very real and very British. And also it makes me cry a couple of times. There's a couple of moments in it, like when one of them talks about their, you know, their parents splitting up. And it's kind of everything all at once. It's so funny and so heartwarming, and I watch it every year without fail. And I think is a lot of people over here, especially older people, would definitely probably remember it, but it's not as big a thing kind of thing. People don't maybe watch every year, but I always say to everyone, if they haven't watched it, they need to watch it.
What is it about Christmas that motivates you to have a podcast?
I have like internal warm feeling when I think about Christmas, like all year through. It just cheers me up as a Christmas podcast all year round. I'll put on a Christmas song if I'm feeling a bit down in my headphones after a difficult day of work, or I'll go and watch something on YouTube a bit Christmassy, or and as I'm preparing stuff for the podcast each month, it's a little bit of, you know, it's a bit of joy, it's a bit of smiling. It just makes me happy. It's like this internal glow, and almost like a secret glow for me as well, kind of all through the year, you know, that everyone else isn't doing it and it's just for me. I will sit down with a cup of tea and kind of watch a Christmas thing, and it will just make me think of all the Christmas celebrations and memories and happiness and, you know, festivity. And then it puts me in a nice place for a little while, no matter what else is going on kind of thing.
Adam, I used to all the time listen to Christmas music just to kind of mellow me out a little bit, because I used to travel a lot for business and I'd be on the plane happy and smiling, and people were probably like, why is that guy so happy? Literally, I was listening, I had my Christmas list of songs I'd listen to. I don't care what month it was.
Make sure you just spend as much time as you can with those people, you know, your friends and your family, the ones you love. And Christmas is the perfect time for it. You know, it's the excuse to be, oh, why don't we meet up? Yeah. Why don't we go for a curry? Why don't we go to the pub? Why don't we go for a walk? Why don't we go? And, you know, that is such a nice, again, a nice excuse, I suppose. Christmas is the excuse to spend time with people. Not that you should need one, but if it gives you that impetus, then use that.
And like you said, you know, often you'll talk to people and say, we ought to get together. What I like, Christmas usually forces people, you do get together. You're like, let's sit down and let's go do it.
Merry Christmas, guys.
Merry Christmas, Adam. Really happy
for the time.
Yeah, lovely meeting you guys. Lovely to be on.
Merry Britsmas.
So, Bob, I'm so excited about this episode, because typically when we have to talk about how to say Merry Christmas, you have me say things that have 27 letters.
All consonants.
But I'm excited to talk about why do the Brits say Happy Christmas?
I don't know. Why do they?
Well, in England, you'll hear Happy Christmas just as often as Merry Christmas. So the question is, why? They were singing We Wish You a Merry Christmas in the 16th century, and nephew Fred tells Scrooge to have a Merry Christmas in A Christmas Carol in 1843. So if Merry Christmas is traditional and has been around for centuries, why say happy versus merry?
Yeah, why?
The answer is in the interpretation of the word over the time. They may seem to be synonyms. However, the term merry once meant delightful and joyous, but later came to mean rowdy and boisterous.
Is there a problem?
Yeah. At the same time, happy originally meant lucky or fortunate, but later evolved to mean pleasing or contented. The royal family played a significant role in making Happy Christmas popular, using happy because it had higher class and more reserved connotation than the vulgar common merry. Early church leaders in Great Britain also engaged their followers to simply be happy in their celebrations rather than engage in merrymaking.
Isn't that hilarious? Now I'm really more stuck on him. Merry Christmas.
I mean, it's merrymaking, not hanky-panky. So whether you plan to be merry, indicating a bit of a tipsy, gregarious event, or happy, reflecting a more restrained or spiritual experience, make it your best. Enjoy yourself unconditionally. While we don't have the challenges of Victorian England, we do have different stresses and concerns, so spread good cheer and do it the best you can. To quote our friend, the Ghost of Christmas Present, make sure that it is kindly given and that it goes to those who need it the most.
I will never say Happy Christmas again.
Yeah, really.
I want a boisterous and bawdy Christmas.
Yeah, I'm merry all the way. So, you know what's amazing, Bob? Mm. That there's absolutely no traditions in England.
I know. It's a
zero.
Shame. They don't do anything.
Nothing. Let's go right to music.
This calls for some Christmas music.
No. Let's talk about some of the customs. So ever since 1947, Norway has gifted a Christmas tree to London's Trafalgar Square as a thank you for Britain's support during World War II. This annual tradition began after the war to symbolize the close friendship between the two nations when the Norwegian royal family and government took refuge in Britain during the German occupation. During the Second World War, Great Britain was Norway's closest ally. I never knew that, actually.
No, I didn't either.
The Norwegian king and government fled to London when our country was occupied, and it was from there that much of Norway's resistance work was organized. Both the BBC and its Norwegian counterpart, NRK Broadcast, and both broadcasted in Norwegian from London, something that was both an important source of information and a morale boost for those who remained in Norway, where people would listen in secret in fear of the strict Nazi ban on radios. After the war, Norway began sending Christmas trees to London every year as just a mere thank you.
And that's so nice.
It is.
And
so
I love
nice.
That they still do it. You
yeah,
know?
It's a great tradition. A Christmas Carol in prose, Being a Ghost of Christmas, is the full name of the novella by Charles Dickens, first published in 1843. And, you know, as our fans know, we did a special just on the Christmas Carol about a year ago. But by 1843, Dickens had began to suffer from financial problems with his wife and their fifth child. A Christmas Carol was completed in just 6 weeks.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, I mean, he's just under pressure to produce so he could get paid, with the final changes being written in early December. He would take night walks of 15 to 20 miles around London to draft the story in his head. Think about how far that is.
I know.
He was influenced by experience of his own youth. He experienced his own hardship at 12 when his parents and younger brothers were put in debtor's jail. He had to work off their debts working in a blacking factory to pay their bills. It made him a passionate advocate of the poor and defenseless. And you think about that, knowing now what the book's about.
Yeah.
Dickens' generosity extended far beyond his own needs. He supported many charities and rarely passed a beggar on the street without pressing a coin in his hand. A Christmas Carol was published on December 19th, with the first edition being sold out by Christmas Eve.
And think about that time. Now, you don't know how many copies they have, but still, in 6 days.
By the end of 1844, 13 more editions had been released. Christmas as we know it, family gathering, seasonal food and drink, games, festive generosity, even saying Merry Christmas is largely the result of a Christmas Carol. In the early 19th century, the celebration of Christmas was associated with the countryside and peasant revelry, disconnected from the increasing urbanization and industrialization taking place. Dickens showed that Christmas could be celebrated in towns and cities, so it led to this revival of the Christmas holiday.
So they thought it was more country and rural, right. Kind of looked down on it.
I think we talked about this, but just as a refresher, tenants in medieval England were invited to the Lord's Castle for Christmas dinner, which sounds so nice, but they had to provide the food and bring their own plates, napkins, and firewood.
You're invited over, but...
That's so British. Christmas offered the opportunity for lavish meals and festivals. Christmas was the highlight of the year. With a 14-day holiday from Christmas Eve to the 12th day, the castle was decorated with holly, ivy, and bay. A huge Yule log was put in the Great Hall's fireplace and burned for the duration of the holiday. The local tenants also could eat at the castle, so as long as they brought their own food and their own dishes and their own firewood, they could take away any leftovers. And there was a game called the Ancient Christmas Game, where the lucky finder of a bean buried in one of the bread loaves could act as the king in the feast.
They keep hiding things in food. I'm not a big fan of that. What if you break your tooth?
Exactly. Another tradition, according to old European custom, local deaths were announced by the ringing of church bells. In England, the sound was known as the death knell. Folk beliefs asserted that the devil died when Jesus was born. Some towns would ring the church bells near midnight on Christmas Eve to announce the devil's death. In England, the custom was called tolling or ringing the devil's knell. It dates back to the mid-13th century. It was briefly discontinued in the early 1800s and then interrupted again in 1940 during World War II when bell ringing was forbidden. It started again in 1948, and according to the custom, bell ringing begins at 11 p.m. on Christmas Eve and is timed to end at midnight.
I would never have known that it meant that the devil has died.
I never heard that before, honestly. An old legend explains the history of the devil's knell bell and hints at another origin for Christmas Eve bell ringing custom. The legend is, long ago, a man of means murdered a young man in his service. As penance for his crime, he requested that the bell toll every year on Christmas Eve as a reminder of his sin. This is a fun one. "We Wish You a Merry Christmas" is an English Christmas carol by the British composer, conductor, and organist Arthur Worrall. It was published under the title A Merry Christmas, West Country Traditional Song. Its origins lie in the English tradition wherein wealthy people of the community gave Christmas treats to the carolers on Christmas Eve, such as figgy pudding. "We Wish You a Merry Christmas" has three more verses, all which revolve around the singer's demand for figgy pudding. The lyrics for another English carol, "Deck the Halls," were originally "Fill the mead cup, drain the barrel," and not "Down we now our gay apparel."
Oh, wow.
Interesting. The phrase "fill the mead cup, drain the barrel" are from the original 1862 English lyrics of a Christmas carol, "Deck the Halls," written by Thomas Oliphant, which describe a boozy celebration. Yeah, baby.
They said Merry Christmas.
The more common modern version replaces this line with "Don we now our gay apparel" to remove the reference to drinking, a change that appeared in printing around 1877. The change was made to remove the references to drinking, making the song more family-friendly and less focused on alcohol.
And to create chuckles.
Yeah. Artificial Christmas trees, I didn't know this either until this episode, were invented by a British toilet brush company in the 1930s.
Toilet brush company.
This is totally British humor. The British Otis Brush Company produced the first mass-produced trees. The trees are made from the same animal hair or nylon bristles and machinery used to manufacture the toilet brushes. The only difference was the bristles were dyed green. The company developed the trees to offer a more realistic-looking alternative to earlier, sparser versions that were made from goose feathers. Artificial trees existed before this, but most notably German-made trees from the 19th century that used goose feathers dyed green. The Otis brush trees were sturdier than the feather trees and could hold heavier ornaments. This method was later improved upon in 1950s using PVC plastic to create more realistic-looking fire-retardant trees.
Don't you just have this image in your head of this Christmas tree that looks like a bunch of toilet brushes sticking out?
For any Gen Xer listeners or Nick at Night fans, you know that whenever the Brady Bunch went on vacation, it ended with a cliffhanger. So, with Mark and Bob still in England, this will be a two-parter.
A two-parter!
Tune in next episode to discover if Bob recreates the Hugh Grant jump dance scene from Love Actually at 10 Downing Street. See if Mark commits an international faux pas when he fails to curtsy for King Charles. And watch if the boys get disappointed when they find out Piccadilly is not a real circus.
Oh man, what?
Yes, it's part two of our
Festive Foreign Film Fan Special! Royal English Christmas / New Year's Triple Stuffed Podcast Episode Extravaganza.
Same bad time, same bad channel on January 25th.
Actually, we're done.
Done, done.
It's over, 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 it's over.
It's over, kaput, finito.
It's over. It's over. It's over.
This has been a Waysound Studio production.
And sound engineering on our show is by Jake Fontana.